Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
This is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast. Welcome back to the podcast. No Claire today. She's on leave, but she'll be back. So, Caroline, good week. Have you been out much?
What do you think? No, it's just the strangest time ever, really. Every single email I've sent out to like a work contact or anything, it's always just been, hi, hope you're well under the circumstances, but you know, all the strange times we're living in at the moment. So no, not been out anywhere, just very much self-isolating at home. Although, touch wood, I'm not ill or anything. I haven't got any of the signs or symptoms, just in the interests of staying safe.
But you did nip out to the shops at one point at least and had an interesting experience.
Yeah, I had someone steal my toilet rolls out of my basket there. But yeah, I went to the self-service checkout and I didn't have any bags with me, which it's probably my fault. I deserve to have my toilet rolls taken because I didn't have any bags with me. But I turned my back to ask the shop assistant for a carrier bag so I could take my shopping home. And just so I was talking to her, I saw her eye line sort of, she didn't look at me. She kind of looked beyond me. And then the next, she's just, excuse me, sir, put those down. And there was some guy, yeah, just trying to half inch my toilet roll. So for that reason as well, I'm just not leaving the house. Everyone's gone crazy. Just rather avoid it all and hunker down.
Yeah. Oh, he's not going to be winning GQ Gentleman of the Year.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
I would hazard. Mm. Well, I've also been, after getting back from a brief visit home to Glasgow, I've essentially been just working from home. Nipped out to the supermarket earlier in the week. And it's amazing to see all the kind of bog roll and dried pasta and stuff just gone.
Yeah.
But I suppose highlight of my week, as it has been for the last few weeks, is also a kind of medical related thing. I watched my nephew having his tonsils taken out on television.
Ooh, how?
So, and twice.
Twice? How many pairs of tonsils does he have?
Well, my nephew is an actor. He's in Outlander. And in this week's episode, his two characters, because he plays the Beardsley twins, Kezia and Josiah, had their tonsils out. And it was quite a gruesome sight.
Mm.
It's one thing to see a member of your family in a television drama or a TV program, but to see two of them is experience. Yeah, Outlander, very, very big profile show in the US, not so much here, so he can still walk around and not be recognized.
Should he be though? Self-isolation? He probably should be staying home as it is.
This is true. But hopefully once all this is over. Top line on the podcast, I mean, we're both going to talk corona. Caroline, you're going to retail stuff?
Looking at just how, obviously we've all seen the headlines around how, and we talked about already around the impact this is having on kind of bricks and mortar retailers, but also the trickle down effect it's having, or the related effect it's having on online retail, firms like Amazon, Ocado and stuff like that as well.
I'm also going to talk about the virus and data. Surprise, surprise. But yeah, let's start with you, Caroline.
We've all seen the social media posts around empty sort of supermarket shelves, people queuing around the block sort of early in the morning before the supermarkets open because of panic buying, stockpiling and stuff like that.
I think they've been looted.
Yeah, I know. It does. It's,
they have.
Yeah. I mean, we're already living in a situation that feels very kind of like the end of the world, and stuff like this is just not helping any of those vibes at the moment. You know, the major supermarkets mainly, before, you know, as soon as they're stocked, it's gone again. So because of that, and also combined with the fact that people are being told to self-isolate and avoid going out, this has led to a kind of uptick or an uplift, if you like, in the amount of people also trying to order stuff online. So Amazon have seen a sizable shift in sort of people, an unseasonal shift, actually, they were saying, in the number of people ordering goods online. So this time of year, post-Christmas, is usually when they start scaling back the number of temporary workers they have in their fulfillment centres and in their and sort of delivery and logistics side as well. But because of this just absolutely unprecedented sort of situation we all find ourselves in at the minute, people having to order more product or ordering, as they say, critical supplies online, we are seeing Amazon responding by saying they need to start hiring more people. So in the US, they've announced that they're hiring 100,000 additional workers to help them meet the demand they're seeing for online goods. And that's being matched by a $350 million investment in pay for their staff as well. So that means in the UK, Europe and US, the staff they've got at the minute are going to see a pay bump in the region of, it's going to be £2 extra an hour for their workers in the UK, €2 extra an hour for their employees in Europe, and $2 extra an hour for their employees in the US as well. So for Amazon, that, you know, it's a huge amount of investment. And they're also, but it's not just them as well. I was looking before we came on the podcast right now, I said the impact on supermarkets has seen a massive rise in the number of stores at the moment requesting temporary workers there. So if you go on any of the online job sites, there's a huge, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of listings now for temporary supermarket workers. So either delivery drivers to fulfill online orders, but also overnight operatives, which might be people who are sort of stacking the shelves, but also ensuring in the morning when the morning orders go out that they have the online orders, they've got all the stock ready to throw out for those deliveries as well. And I guess the other thing we have to factor into all of this is that absenteeism because of coronavirus is going to, you know, there's going to be an uptick in that inevitably. And so that makes it quite hard for any business at the moment just to sort of get any kind of indication or know or any sort of definite handle on what staffing levels are going to be like, you know, day to day, week to week at the moment. So the temporary workforce is going to be really important in order to make sure that as they're seeing all this demand, they've definitely got enough people on hand who can ensure that, you know, people do get their shopping, people, and in a timely manner as well. So yeah, so much going on. But on the other side of things, we've got this, Ocado, the online-only supermarket as well. They are seeing, again, a huge uptick in demand for kind of online delivery slots as people don't want to go out. But also, as they go into the bricks and mortar supermarkets, they get in there and finding they don't have the things they want. So they think, oh, okay, I'll go on to Ocado and maybe they've got what I'm after instead. And I thought it was Claire Cormack, our production editor. She was sort of said online earlier this week on Skype during our Computer Weekly Skype chat that was something like, what is it, 1,000 and something in the queue for an Ocado order or something like that. And it's because, you know, people are, you know, rushing to the website. But because of that, they pulled their website and their mobile app because they wanted to make some changes on the back end, I suspect, either to sort of alter the way that the orders are made, because they were saying that it's a big push for them is they want to make sure that it's not just first come, first serve, that there is that, you know, goods are being, the people who are maybe more vulnerable or, you know, haven't been able to be first in the queue to get goods can sort of, you know, get what they need as well. So there's, I don't know, we don't know exactly what changes they're putting, because the website and mobile app at the time of recording are still offline. They're still going to be offline till tomorrow, they said the 21st of March, it should be coming back. But yeah, they said they need to make some changes on the back end, but also as well, they were product shortages as well. So they said they need to make some changes to their sort of logistics and supply chain to make sure that when people place orders, they are going to get the things that they've ordered and stuff like that as well. But yeah, it'll be interesting over the next couple of weeks to see just how retailers, bricks and mortar, online retail as well, sort of rise to the challenge of this. Because also at the same time as all this has been going on, we've seen lots of headlines about sort of the toll that all this is taking on sort of high streets as people are staying indoors, restaurant chains, stuff like that, pubs, lots of different things. So yeah, I think it'd be an interesting one to see how the retail industry adopts to these kind of strange times we're living in at the moment.
Yeah, and the government's been Rishi Sunak, we talked about his budget last week, but he's been back on these daily press conferences a couple of times and announcing what looks like quite impressive support
for
a whole range of businesses, mixture of loans and grants and things like that.
It doesn't seem like 10 days or was it 11 days ago now we had the budget. That seems like just another lifetime ago, right? They've made some interesting sort of changes this week, but then there has been a little bit of criticism that sort of the package of measures they put in place to support businesses haven't quite been enough. But, you know, it's one of these things, it's obviously the government has to respond, but this is just a as I keep saying, we're on a wartime footing. These are just a set of circumstances, but I think it will take a little while for them to get, you know, everything in place that they need to support businesses. And, you know, there was the thing this week that they're gonna, it's on a bit of a tangent, but they said they were gonna offer mortgage holidays for people.
Yeah,
you know, if you can't, you know, if you can't pay your mortgage because of, you know, COVID-19 related kind of shortfall in
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, they were like, well, where's, that's fine, but, you know, we have a huge number of people in this country who live in rented accommodation. What's the provisions being offered for them? And at the moment, there there hasn't really been anything. So, you know, it's there's still a lot that needs to be announced, or some more assurances to people that we're hoping to see as well. But yeah, like I say, I'm sure this won't be the last of the last podcast that we'll be talking about that kind of stuff, government action on all this to relieve some of the strain. But yeah, it's. It is, like I say, it's just a strange time to be living in.
I was interested to hear about that kind of job explosion almost that you're referring to. There was a poor fellow on the Today programme this morning, we're recording on Friday the 20th, a Spanish guy, a waiter working for a hotel, and he was just being laid off, I mean, with immediate effect. And he lived in the hotel as well, so...
Oh, really?
He has nowhere to live.
But
at least it does sound as though there are jobs of some kind
Well the Amazon recruitment drive I spoke about, they've said specifically they are looking to target people who are out of work at the moment from the service industry, but, you know, the people who work in the pubs and the bars and the restaurants and everything else, like, can they provide them with some kind of, you know, lifeline, economic lifeline to sort of keep them employed and stuff like that, which is, you know, it's really good to see. But yeah, there are, like I say, there's opportunities out there, but at the same time, it's sort of supporting the growth of, or it's kind of jobs that mean people might be in the front line in terms of exposure to the virus as well, which is something important to keep in mind, particularly temporary supermarket workers. But yeah, it's good to see there is some replacement employment coming online as well.
A big a lot of anxiety, I should imagine, among self-employed people, freelancers. For some of our copy, and of course the IT contractor community, a lot of them are self-employed.
Yeah, they've seen a lot of instability over the last few months with the looming threat of the IR35 reforms over them. But then, yeah, it's announced this week that the IR35 reforms are going to be deferred, so they're not going to come into force in April 2020 as originally planned. They're going to be put back by a year. So, because, you know, to give private sector organisations who will be affected by them more time to prepare. Well, but is it more time to prepare, or is it just to give them some breathing space because there's so much other stuff going on at the moment? It's just something else they don't need on their plate. So it remains to be seen if it will be kind of something they think, okay, if we've got more time, we'll, or is it just be completely pushed to the back burner and they forget about it? But really, you know, it's positive for private sector firms who haven't quite got their houses in order yet with IR35. They've got over 12 months to sort that out. But for the IT contractors themselves, I've been speaking to a few of them over the last few days on this, and the general consensus is that there won't be a huge amount of benefit for them, or at least they don't see any benefit at the moment, mainly because a lot of the decisions around IR35, as we've been reporting on, you know, companies, private sector companies responding to this, and we're banning contractors, a lot of those decisions were made, sort of started to be made sort of October, November, December, so a lot of these people have been out of work for a while, and we are seeing some companies sort of start to roll back some of those decisions, and they've started to say, okay, look, you know, we've got more time to prepare, we are going to use limited company contractors again. But then we're also seeing lots of others who haven't, who are just like, okay, well, that's the company policy now. So if you were out of work before because of IR35, you're still going to be, basically, in some of those instances. But then also there's the trust element of things. You know, their initial response to the IR35 reforms was to can all their contractors. So if you're a contractor looking for dependable work in a very volatile market at the moment because of coronavirus, let's not forget Brexit's still happening somewhere. So it's kind of, would you rush back, you know, to work for companies that, you know, previously they were very quick to get rid of you? It's there's, you know, sort of, yeah, there's the reputational side of things as well. Like, would you want to work for those companies again? But yeah, lots of them have already put in plans that are very difficult to roll back. The IT contractors I'm referring to now. So I wrote about this for Computer Weekly a few weeks ago now, but one of the things we were seeing was that because so many companies have said we don't want to use limited company contractors anymore, we were inundated with anecdotes and sort of accounts from contractors who were telling us that they were in the throes of shutting down their limited companies so they could, you know, as a result. And once you've shut down a limited company, you can't start another one for another 2 years. So they can't return to being limited company contractors, for example. We also had people telling us that, you know, their plan was to move abroad and find work. And a lot of them the people I've been talking to this week, those plans haven't changed. Yes, there's travel bans. Yes, maybe they won't be able to act on those plans as quickly as they would like because of coronavirus. But the long term, their plan is to leave the UK and take their skills with them. And for people who've already decided they were going to retire, you know, they've gone off into the sunset. You know, it's the main beneficiaries of the IR35 deferral will be the private sector organisations and anyone who hadn't quite got their act together on it, really, I think.
You've been a busy boy, the new Chancellor.
Yeah.
I wonder if Sajid Javid is regretting.
I bet he's relieved. Just like, oh, God, it's such hard work.
From the real world business implications of coronavirus to the data connected with the virus itself and the progress of it and also the longer term implications as well. So I took a briefing this week from a lady called Julie Kay. Julie is executive director of Click.org, which is the kind of philanthropic wing of Click, which is a Swedish-based business intelligence software vendor.
Mm-hmm.
Partly regarding the work that they do, sort of pro bono and kind of donating their software to charities and NGOs and things like that, but also with regard to the work they do with a thing called the Private Sector Roundtable, which is the PSRT, which involves Click, but also involves some quite big hitting industrial and pharmaceutical companies like GE, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson. And this came out of the Ebola crisis. That's what was formed after that epidemic. And the idea was to try and have a kind of collective group of private sector organizations who have a lot of resources that public sector, you know, doesn't have, to have a collective of those that NGOs could engage with. Because a lot of charities are NGOs, not-for-profits, as the Americans would say, you know, they want to engage and get the value of what private sector companies have to offer, not just IT companies, but IT companies, like, you know, from our point of view.
Mm.
That's the relevant kind of bet, but they don't necessarily know how to do that. So that was the concept, according to her, of this roundtable. And so the kind of the NGOs who engage with them include the World Health Organization, barely off our television screens.
Mm, yeah.
And the CDC, which I must admit, I'd never heard of the CDC, but it's our American colleagues talk about that, don't they?
Yeah.
Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So that's the kind of groups they work with. But one of the interesting things that she said to me about that was that every country will do a kind of a resilience report for how, this is WHO, for how well they're positioned with respect to resisting an epidemic like Ebola or in this case coronavirus. But these are like 30, 40, 50, 100-page reports, PDFs.
Mm.
And they did this very simple thing, Click, of digitizing those PDFs and making them searchable and having an app that enables the data to be extracted and analysed quite easily. And she said it's the sort of thing that if you saw it at HSBC, you would just shrug your shoulders, you know.
Mm.
That's not a big deal. But for some of these NGOs, that is a big deal. And that's not cutting edge artificial intelligence. It's not about applying sophisticated machine learning models to data. It's a really kind of simple use case that is nevertheless pretty useful for these kind of organizations. With respect to Corona, this is Click. They work with a charity called Direct Relief. And they've worked with them for a number of years. But in this particular case, they've done a dashboard for them that combines supply chain data with coronavirus data. And the point of that is to direct gloves and masks and gowns and ventilators to the right places. Mm. And this is especially going to be a problem. Well, it's a problem for us. But I mean, when this virus really hits Africa, you know, that's when you're going to need to have data that will enable you to kind of target where you send stuff and go on. So they're not Click, and they're not really doing, you know, the kind of data analysis on the virus itself. That's more for medical institutions and data scientists who are working with, so much the kind of business intelligence software that we might use or our marketing colleagues might use, but they'll be using R and Python, and they'll be doing, you know, proper coding and devising kind of machine learning models that I can't even begin to describe to you. But that's more the data scientists will be doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, Click does, you know, they feed into the kind of the value chain there as well, and their software is used by those sort of people too, and as part of what they do. But she did see it. She had another side to her conversation which hadn't occurred to me. But I suppose if you think about it, it's fairly obvious, is that just because we have coronavirus doesn't mean all the other diseases in the world have stopped happening. And then when it comes to things like charities, which is what, you know, Click.org works with charities and gives their software for free. So, for example, one of their one of the organizations they work with is Great Ormond Street.
Mm.
So the development team at Great Ormond Street, you know, they use Click software to, make their campaigns to raise money as efficient as possible. And there are lots of other charities who use this kind of software to do that sort of thing. But because, you know, the pressure of and the prominence of coronavirus, it's going to be more demanding to do that as efficiently as possible. And one simple thing she said to me was, you know, she'd run in the London Marathon. People will, I don't know exactly when it is, not something that I would have participated in myself, but you know, lots of people running that for Cancer Research UK and the British Heart Foundation, and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there's that kind of collateral damage.
Mm. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that either, actually. Yeah, you kind of think all the runners and their training now, you know, they have to either keep it up or sort of scale it back. But then, yeah, you forget the reason why so many people run is, yeah, for the fundraising element. So what's going to happen to, you know, the research teams that rely on that sort of annual boost in funding that events, and not just that, you know, so many marathons, so many other events that take place throughout the year that, you know, so highly reliant on that, yes.
And also on the kind of the data front, our colleague Cliff Saren, he's been on fire around coronavirus.
Yeah.
doesn't have a high temperature as far as we can tell, but he's written quite a lot. And a couple of his stories that I'll pick out. Like I said, the Computer Weekly team's been doing a lot of stuff on this topic. But one is a story that is based on a Gartner report about three technology areas that CIOs must address. Readers can go and read this for themselves, and we'll put it in the summary article, but it's basically around one thing is working from home and enabling that to happen on a scale that's never been done before, and all the kind of specific problems that throws up. Another thing that this report picks up on is you know, firms, commercial firms, should think about opening up their data if that's helpful to public health authorities. Another thing that's in the report that I know that Cliff has got a bit of a bee in his bonnet about this is something very well saying to manufacturers, switch from making, I don't know, bicycle pumps to making ventilators.
Yeah, yes.
There's all the software that's behind that in the first place, kind of ERP software, how simple or difficult is it to, you know, to change that around? And another thing is just the idea of using data analytics again to kind of mitigate some of the supply chain disruption problems. And the other story that Cliff did is more on the virus itself is Microsoft and Google. It's actually six organizations involved in this. And they've put together a COVID-19 data set, which is called the COVID-19 Open Research Data Set, or CORD-19 for short. And the basic idea there is to say to the kind of data scientists of the world, you know, here's this data set, which is supposedly the biggest kind of literature kind of data set on the coronavirus that exists. And the US government's involved in this too. It's a White House connected thing. Basically saying to data scientists all over the world, you know, fill your boots, you know, have a go. The data's there. It's there for you, which I suppose is a nice thing for our friends at Google and Microsoft to have done.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think we might have talked a little bit about this when Hannah came on the podcast the other week, but about the sort of regard to sort of events, pandemics and things like this, the ability for people, groups, people to use technology to sort of connect, collaborate and find sort of either solutions or just accelerate research is very, very important. So it's, well, I say it's interesting to see it in action, but you kind of wish you didn't have to see it in action as well. But no, it's interesting to see how, yeah, firms are sort of stepping up in that regard.
This also written the leader. Well, I think it's basically his blog post. It's been repurposed as a leader in this week's issue. I think the gist of it is there's an awful lot of work for IT professionals to be doing in respect of the coronavirus. And he says IT is going to have to be more agile and more collaborative, less competitive and things like that. That's what Cliff's stuff has been. But the whole team has been working hard on it. And we're all working from home.
It's been, well, it's as we were saying yesterday on when we were having our pre-call, it's before the podcast, it's on the one hand, it's kind of, well, you know, this is business as usual. You know, everyone on the team does kind of work from home quite regularly, but it's, yeah. I think it's the suddenly everyone having to do it en masse, but also for an indefinite amount of time is just, I think the first week we're all quite upbeat. But I think it'd be interesting to see. There's the week to go on.
Jolly at the moment, yeah.
Yeah.
Caroline from Data to Data Centres, I know you've...
There's been a few interesting things this week, actually. Like I say, this whole, you know, Computer Weekly, we're not alone in suddenly being a sort of predominantly office-based workforce, so suddenly everybody having to work from home. You know, the advice from the government, as much as possible, is that if you can work from home, please do. You know, this is all part of the, you know, the strategy to flatten the curve and try and reduce the, you know, the pace of infections and things like that, so that, you know, the NHS doesn't become overloaded. So, but on that point, the fact that suddenly that we've got all these people who are, you know, 9 a.m. if you're a 9-to-5 worker, you know, at 9 a.m. sort of firing up the computers every day and then trying to log back into systems based in the office because you've got a server room somewhere that where all your applications are still hosted. There is a concern that, you know, CIOs are going to start to see, because of this, maybe some of the creakingness of their infrastructure. Just, you know, it's being put under sort of just an unprecedented amount of stress and strain this week. And, you know, what should they be doing to sort of react to that? So, you know, sort of from a data center point of view, like I say, there seems to be, from the people I'm speaking to on this week, because we've been all been writing sort of articles on this to help sort of tech teams sort of negotiate this situation. Because it, yeah, I think it's worth saying that, you know, the pace of change that this, that the virus has brought about is, you know, day to day things are changing so quickly. You know, say for example, if we use Computer Weekly as an example, last Friday I left the office and said to Brian, like, oh, I might see you next week. Like Brian Glick, our boss, I was like, oh, I might see you next week, I might not, you know, I might work from home, we'll see. By Monday it was pretty much like, nope, offices are shut down, no one's commuting to London. You know, it's all been very, very sudden. So if you're a CIO, having to adapt to that, and
but even like Matt Hancock, who's you know, featured often in the podcast.
affectionately, I should add.
You know, saying about manufacturers converting to making ventilators, I mean, that was Sunday, I think.
Yeah.
You said that. Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's
a long time ago.
Yeah. But it's the thing for, so for a lot of CIOs, I think there's been advice come out this week from sort of various vendors and suppliers, but also organizations such as the Uptime Institute, who are focused on giving advice to people who run data centers on how to keep them, you know, up and running. And also they're mindful of the fact that maybe some of these data centers might have been on the cusp of being upgraded, or, you know, they might be creaking already, and then suddenly they're being put under a lot of strain. So they've sort of put out sort of guidance this week about what people can do if they need to keep them up and running. You know, where possible, they were saying you should suspend sort of non-essential maintenance and any sort of non-essential migration projects. But if they have to continue, they've issued some really comprehensive guidance on what data center operators, and by data center operators they mean everything, everybody, from either like people who've got a little server room, you know, tucked away in the office somewhere, to people who do have their own sort of private data center, to as well sort of co-location facilities and hyperscalers as well. You know, what can they do? How should they be managing those sites to ensure you've got, like, basically the fewest number of people on sites possible to carry out that work, but also the people you do have on site, how can you keep them safe in terms of interacting with each other and stuff like that? So it's, yeah, it's worth seeking out the full document. But yeah, just, and just things in it that I just hadn't really thought of before. But when you join up the dots a little bit on your thinking about it, you're like, yeah, that makes total sense. So something we've talked about, or written about on Community Week a few times, is the huge skill shortage there is in data centers. You know, it's an industry that, there's figures out a few years ago, so these figures will be out of date now because the people will be even older. But like the average age of a data center worker is, well, they're approaching retirement age. You know, and so there's always been concerns that once they retire and those skills, the data center engineers skills, once they've left, who's going to replace them? It's just not a pipeline of people coming into the industry to replace those workers.
Talking about US Army veterans.
Yeah. There's lots of sort of initiatives like that have been introduced to try and plug those gaps and try and fill in the gaps. So they're sort of saying, yeah, if this is really going to probably become more apparent just how big the skills gap is in the industry over the next few months, because you just, you know, as people, because of absenteeism and things like that, that those, you know, the skills will be in shorter supply. So part of their advice also is, how can you conserve the people we have, make sure they stay healthy and stuff like that. So some of some of their advice is things like, which, like I said, I just hadn't thought of, is like within your data center setup or site, if it's a sizable facility, you've got to provide space that people might have to sleep and live there for a period of time, just so they don't leave the facility and things like that. And which is quite like scary, just imagine, it really hammers home just how big the virus, the impacts it can have on the industry. But yes, there's other, but from the data center point of view as well, there's, like I say, there's kind of a push to, or kind of guidance to sort of suspend anything that's non-essential, any big migration projects, just put those on hold for the time being. You know, CIOs, maybe make the best of what you've got. Because the other aspect to this as well is that, you know, from the supply chain aspect, a lot of the components that will be needed to make servers and storage devices and other appliances that sit in data centers, those supply chains have had to shut down. Also, I think there was something actually in the Uptime report as well, they were saying about some of the manufacturers who make some of the more sort of mechanical engineering parts of data centers, like the cooling system and stuff like that, they are made in Italy, where there's a huge so they're sort of saying that if you do need to carry out works in your data center, you've got to allow for the fact that the parts you need will be in short supply and you won't be able to get hold of them as well. So it's not just a case of staffing, it's the fact that if you've got work project to do, it's probably going to be quite difficult to deliver on those anyway for a long time yet. So yeah, it's just sort of hammering it all home really, what's, you know, going on. Yeah, so there was an email sent out by Dell Technologies this week, for example, which saw them sort of asking their clients for just a bit of a steer on what their sort of data center investment priorities are over the next few months, so they can make sure that their supply chains are in place, you know, to make sure that they can, as they say, keep productivity, I think in this email, at an all-time high, and make sure you can still carry on working. But also as well, it said, as well as data center projects, they also said about if you have, so if you're looking to do a laptop refresh as well, they said if you've got any projects that need more than 5 laptops that you're looking to order in, you need, can you give them a sort of an indication about that as well? So yeah, people, you know, say tech firms trying to make sure they've got stock and they've got sort of mechanisms in place to keep their clients' lights on as well during all of this. Yeah. So,
Yeah, sometimes, you know, we forget that it's a manufacturing business.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To some extent, IT. I mean, on the software side, it's very easy for us to think it's all, you know, ethereal.
Yeah, it's all done in a data center somewhere, but we don't know what's happening there. Yeah.
I think we're... That's probably all we've got this week. We need to get back to watching our box sets on iPlayer.
Speak for yourself. I'm waiting for the Daily Boris, his daily press conference. That's how I know my working day's finished, once he comes out and tells us what the latest doom and gloom is about everything.
I was pleased to see that the Spooks is on the iPlayer, all 10.
Yeah.
10 series of Spooks.
Yeah, we should probably have a dig through and see if there's anything we can do, like we did with the Holby City thing last year. If there's any TV shows that have been resurfaced that might be fun to look at from a tech perspective. Probably how dated the technology has become in it.
Exactly. Given something.
Yeah.
Actually, just thinking about it now, I mean, I was being semi-serious there, but the Spooks, some of the tech that will be in that, and there is a fair amount of tech in Spooks, that will, some of the earlier stuff will be quite funny to see.
We'll crack on and do some proper but then also we can say
proper research
into what's in there, but we can say it's work because it's for the podcast, so there you go.
Well, this was our first go at doing the podcast remotely. We've not had our usual visual clues, listeners. Bear with us. We'll be bringing in other colleagues as well as the long weeks of isolation drag on.
Yes.
Especially our Claire, who's on leave at the moment. But on this occasion, it just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
Thanks, Brian.
You can thank me as well.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for listening. Take care and keep well. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.